This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Way back in 2004, two Princeton scientists, Stephen Pakula and Robert Sokolow, wrote in the journal Science, and I quote, "Humanity can solve the carbon and climate problem in the first half of this century simply by scaling up what we already know how to do." They broke up the problem of greenhouse gas emissions into sections they famously called wedges. Each represented a sector of pollution with ways to scale that back over 50 years. But we didn't do much of anything except increase emissions. A new article published in the journal Environmental Research Letters suggests we may have lost that chance with just those 8 years of delay. Let's dig into that deeper with one of the authors of the new assessment, Dr. Stephen J. Davis. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. Stephen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Steve, can you start by explaining the original idea and hope behind the wedges?
Sure. So when the guys at Princeton, Robert Sokolow and Steve Pakula, wrote the paper, they were reacting to sort of the dominant line in the Bush administration at the time, which was climate change is such a daunting problem that we really have no way to tackle it. And so they wanted to emphasize that we actually had a lot of tools that we could start down the path of mitigating climate change. And so they took what was a business-as-usual trajectory of emissions that were expected it to be in the future, which would rise over time, and they said if we could just create deploy technologies that would decrease those emissions such that we could hold our emissions constant for 50 years and then decrease those emissions afterwards, after 50 years, by a couple percent a year, that we could hold the atmospheric levels of CO2 to 500 ppm. Which at the time was what climate scientists were saying would avoid the worst climate impacts.
Well, that raises a lot of questions, but let's suppose we could manage to stop increasing CO2 emissions every year. We just stay at our current levels. What happens?
When they originally wrote the paper in 2004, they calculated that it would take about 7 of these wedges, and so the wedge unit is defined as growing from 0 emissions avoided to 1 billion tons of carbon avoided over the course of 50 years, 1 billion tons a year, so that the cumulative amount of emissions avoided by a single wedge is about 25 billion tons. It is 25 billion tons. And they said 7 of these could reduce the business-as-usual growth pattern and hold it constant. And so by holding it constant, like I said, they said we could stay under 500 ppm. The problem is that since 2004, our emissions have increased, and moreover, they've accelerated. The growth rate has accelerated such that we actually need more than 7 wedges now just to stabilize emissions, at least 9 and perhaps more, and we can get into that a little more. But the new elevated level of annual emissions means that if you held today's emissions constant for 50 years, you'd be right at 2 degrees of warming and over 500 ppm before you even started any sort of reduction in emissions.
Wow. Well, it seems we're on our way to accomplishing one of the Princeton wedges. They called for doubling fuel efficiency in cars from 30 miles per gallon to 60, and that's just shy of 4 liters per 100 kilometers for our European listeners. So what wedges fell apart so badly that our emissions keep increasing every year?
Well, I mean, the one that people really point at is that the developing world, and particularly places like China and India, have really been growing like gangbusters, and they've been doing that using really carbon-intensive sources of energy like coal. And so this is why emissions have grown and why the growth rate has accelerated, as I mentioned.
Well, I've got to ask the simple questions first. Why can't we make the original 7 wedges bigger?
Sure. Well, you know, the wedge, as they defined it, was sort of a unit, like a meter or a gallon or a liter, as you said a minute ago. And so really what we've done in the new paper is to calculate the new number of wedges that you would need to offset the problem. It's not that you have to stop with one wedge of a certain technology. You could have 2 or 3, but the wedge is a unit now that's a handy one for referring to the size of the challenge.
And I'm presuming your team tried to figure out what would prevent horrible climate change, and I realize those answers are many and huge, but why don't we start with what we need to just stabilize at our current emission levels?
Sure. So, you know, we said that 9 wedges of emissions would be able to avoid growth in emissions and hold our emissions constant right now. And we didn't really list out specific ideas in this paper. This was more revisiting the idea of whether a wedge concept was useful to solve the problem, as the original paper said. So, you know, in the original paper, they had 15 different options of wedges. And so we could go through some of those if you're interested. But, you know, it would take 9 of those now to actually just stabilize emissions.
Here's a big question. Can we save ourselves from horrible climate change using existing technology?
Well, so there's a lot packed into that phrase, existing technology. I mean, we show in the paper that if you, instead of just stabilizing emissions at current levels, if you actually start deploying enough wedges to reduce those emissions before 50 years, you can avoid 2 degrees of warming. It's still physically possible to do that. The question then becomes whether you have to come up with new technologies to produce energy without emitting CO2, or if, as Pakala and Sokolow originally suggested, we've got everything we need on the shelf. And so this has been a big debate, and it's been back and forth whether what exactly they meant by current technologies. Of course, everyone knows we have solar photovoltaic panels and wind turbines and nuclear plants, and we know that those things are relatively low carbon sources of energy. So on the one hand, we can say, sure, we could build millions of those literally in order to offset the growth of emissions and we'd solve the problem. But the problem comes, and they didn't really get into this in the original paper, that there's a lot of cost associated with that. And right now, we can't afford to do that in terms of it wouldn't be competitive with fossil fuels, and no one's willing to take the brunt of the cost of that sort of build out. And we're doing our best to incentivize with subsidies and those sorts of things some of the deployment of these technologies, but to do it at the scale that we would need to in order to offset all of the energy that we're getting from fossil fuels would just not be affordable. And so we make a case in the new paper that the way to get to a real solution to the problem would be to really innovate and try to drive the cost of those technologies down and make a concerted effort to deploy as many as you can in the near term.
Well, you know, and I guess we're getting a little off the topic of science here, but that what you just said suggests to me that maybe it's a problem with our economic system. If we have an economic system that says, well, it just doesn't pay to save the climate, maybe that's at the root of the problem.
I think that's right. I've used the metaphor in the past of a diet. And so if you want to lose some weight, you know that you need to stop eating so many cookies, for instance. And so in this metaphor, fossil fuels are the cookies. They're very tempting because they're cheap and we know how to work with them. They're just not as attractive as the more expensive and less familiar technologies of renewable energies and advanced nuclear and these sorts of things. So we're really at a situation where we need to walk away from the cookie jar and start eating more salad, but it's not an attractive thing to do at this point. And so really the challenge for scientists and engineers and the political system as well is to figure out how to make those fossil fuels less attractive and make the alternatives, the salad, the renewable energies, more attractive. And really it comes down to economics.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Stephen J. Davis from the Department of Earth System Science at the University of California. We're looking at whether solutions to climate change have slipped beyond our grasp in just the last 8 years of delaying action. Well, we just talked a little bit about the economy. You know, some of our listeners, indeed a few of our scientific guests, suggest a very different solution. If it's impossible to keep a safe climate living as we do, maybe the system has to collapse. Should we even try to keep this vision of an energy-hungry civilization going?
It's a fair question, and one of my co-authors, Marty Hofford, has talked a little bit about this, that we're in a clash between economics and physics, really, and that if you look at modern capitalist societies, the idea of extending exponential growth indefinitely is really out of step with what we know about the limits of energy and physics in this planet and this universe. We can't simply keep growing indefinitely unless you think we can do that without using energy to do so.
Well, Stephen Davis, who else worked on this journal article with you, and how was it reviewed?
My co-authors were 3 other gentlemen. One is Long Cao, who's now a professor at Zhejiang University in China. He is a great climate modeler and did a lot of the climate runs for us. And then the senior authors on it were Marty Hofford, as I just mentioned, who's a professor at NYU in the physics program there. He's an emeritus, but he's written papers on, seminal papers really, on energy and what needs to happen for energy innovation for a long time. And then my postdoctoral advisor, Ken Caldera, who's a senior scientist at the Carnegie Institution.
And what kind of feedback are you getting to your article? I mean, have you heard from the original Princeton authors?
Sure. And in fact, you know, we all get along very well. I have great respect for Pakala and Sokolow both, and I'm actually working on another article with Rob Sokolow right now. So we've had many exchanges via email about the article. In fact, we're doing some sort of a chat on the Science Magazine website this Thursday with Pakala and I that will be discussing some of these same topics.
Well, frankly, Steve, this seems like good news and bad news. The good news may be that government planners and some Greens assumed we had a relatively easy roadmap out of the climate mess. Now we know that's not true, but of course, that's also the bad news. But do you have any thoughts about what this paper really means for all of us?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just sort of started touching on it in that last comment. What Rob and I have been talking about a lot over email is, what should the target for emissions be? You know, in this paper, we've taken a more aggressive position than that original Wedge paper, and we've said we can't just stabilize emissions for 50 years. We really need to start drawing down emissions now. And so Rob worries that by establishing a more aggressive goal, like phasing out emissions over the next 50 years, which is the alternative we propose, we could become monomaniacal and lose sight of some of the trade-offs, both economic trade-offs and possibly environmental trade-offs, as we try to reach that very difficult goal. And so he thinks that we should follow sort of a more of a middle path, if I understand him correctly. While on the other hand, we argue that if science is telling us that we need to limit warming to 2 degrees, then it seems to me we should set an aspirational goal of what it would take to accomplish that. And even if that's exceedingly daunting and a difficult one, it seems like that our public and our policymakers need to face up to the reality that we're very far off from that goal and see what we can do about it.
Well, I see two problems with the 50-year plan. First of all, it seems like humans will always say, well, if we got 50 years, we don't have to worry about it now. We know that about ourselves. But also, I kind of envisaged, and I know I'm not alone in this, that climate change would happen very slowly over this next century, and we'd see a slight change. But we're seeing big changes already with very low amounts of emissions. Do you think our picture of climate change has also altered and given us more drive to do something?
Sure. I mean, I think you're right that human nature is to react to sort of clear and present danger. And so with extreme weather events like the drought of last summer and Hurricane Sandy, that some of these things have become more salient pictures of what we're in for with climate change. And so that's, on the one hand, terrible that these things are already coming to pass, but on the other hand, it's good that now people can get some picture of what we're in store for, and maybe that'll incentivize us to take the drastic measures necessary to reduce our emissions.
Well, you know, I could see somebody reading your article and coming to the conclusion that it's just plain too late. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, and I think you're getting to what Sokolow is worried about, at least, is if we paint a picture as scientists of the solution that is just too daunting that people might give up and walk away. And I suppose I have a better outlook on the nature of humans to face up to a challenge like that and figure out ways to solve the problem. I'm essentially an optimist, and I think that we can develop the technologies that we need to create the energy we use without emitting CO2, and I think we can do it in time to avoid the worst impacts from climate change, but it is an incredibly daunting challenge, and so, you know, there is the possibility that some policymakers will give up on that or look for easier solutions. This is another fear of looking for things like geoengineering, for instance, that can avert some of the warming and the impacts maybe instead of doing the hard work of actually deploying new energy systems and reducing our emissions.
You've been listening to Stephen J. Davis from the Department of Earth Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's part of a team of scientists who reassessed the famous wedge theory of solving the climate crisis. You can find that article in the journal Environmental Research Letters, and it was published in January 2013. I'll put a link to that paper and a good article by Tim Radford at the Climate News Network in my own blog at ecoshock.info. Steve, thank you so much, even for the bad news.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening. Lots more next week. Be sure to tune in and act out.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.